This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Monday, the 8th of July, these are our main stories. A big surprise in France's parliamentary elections. Projections indicate the far-right National Rally has been beaten into third place after a pact between the left and centre parties. The prominent US Congressman Adam Schiff says Vice President Kamala Harris could beat Donald Trump as concerns continue over Joe Biden's recent public performance. Also in this podcast, the Ukrainian amputee soldiers treated at a US medical center. And after a year living in a sealed room in Texas...
Just ready to come out? Hey!
These people can tell us what it might be like to live on Mars. The French President Emmanuel Macron took a big gamble when he called a snap parliamentary election after the far-right National Rally's success in last month's European elections. Last Sunday's first round of voting saw the National Rally, the former National Front of Jean-Marie Le Pen, renamed and rebranded by his daughter Marine, come top again. But candidates from a hastily formed left-wing coalition, the New Popular Front, struck deals with those from the president's centrist alliance in a bid to stop the National Rally from winning again in the second round. As soon as the polls had closed, early projections confirmed the tactic had worked even better than expected.
Il est 20h et on découvre la nouvelle assemblée. Et ce n'est pas le tiercé qui était attendu à l'issue du premier tour. C'est d'abord la gauche, le nouveau Front Populaire, qui arrive en tête avec 172 à 192
sièges. Announcement on French television that the National Rally had been beaten into third place and wouldn't be forming a government after all. A few minutes after that news broke, I spoke to our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield.
It is a huge surprise. We were all led to believe by the polls that even though the National Rally would go down in this round, it would still emerge as the biggest party. But the pollsters got it all wrong. We got it all wrong. The biggest party, it seems, from this is the left. The left-wing alliance that comprises everyone from the sort of soft socialists, soft left socialists, all the way to pretty hardline anti-capitalist. But they formed this coalition, which meant that left-wing candidates stood down everywhere to concentrate the vote. And there was then, in many places, an alliance with the centrists, so that there was a kind of like a focused anti-RN vote in many constituencies. And clearly this tactic worked, because the RN share of the vote has gone down, and their projection seats, which is what really counts, is way down. I mean, we're talking maybe of them coming in third place behind both the left-wing alliance and even Macron's Ensemble party. So it's a big bucket of cold water over the hard right today, and of course this evening. And of course, victory celebrations go on now in the Place de la République in eastern Paris, where the left has gathered nervously up until a few minutes ago, but now with great joy as they realise that they've actually emerged as essentially the victors of this election.
It's obviously not good for Macron's own party, but does this outcome now mean that his gamble in calling the election and then forming this alliance has paid off?
It's not that bad for his party. I mean, again, you know, compared to what everyone's expecting, you know, they're going to be sort of shaking their heads in disbelief at how fortunate they've been. Because if they come out with 150 to 175 seats, as is predicted, yes, that's way down on what they had before. But they're still in the game, very much so. And in what's going to happen now, which is a prolonged period of haggling and parliamentary-style negotiations, the Ensemble party in the middle, the centre, even though they're not the biggest, will form the kind of hinge block. I mean, no coalition will be possible without them. If there's a coalition that needs to be broad based between a little bit of the right and a large bit of the left, the centre will also play a part in that. So they've come out of this remarkably well. Again, a sign of how well this anti-RN kind of front has worked in this election. Clearly, more people still do not want the RN to take power in France than wanted to, even though in the first round they did so well, and in the Europeans that they did so well.
Our correspondent Hugh Schofield with me from Paris. Let's get some reaction now from some people in France's third largest city, Lyon, just after those predictions came in.
I'm a political science student, so I followed the results of the election, and I'm very happy that the right didn't win, because it was really dangerous for us, because I know that they will prohibit our rights. especially like rights to speech, freedom to say what we want to say. So we're really happy, very happy, and it's not like it's not the end, because there is a lot of people who vote right, and we know that in 2027 for the presidency, I know that it will be complicated, so we have to stay in touch and see.
So happy, yay!
And do you want to tell me anything more? So
okay,
to add
my
to
English
that?
Is broken. I'm so sorry, but I'm I'm very happy because it's dangerous for France and for the comment on jeune. I'm sorry,
for young people.
Yeah, and I'm so happy
since right now the left seems to be a bit ahead. I'm kind of hopeful because we never had that. And so we'll see in like maybe 2 hours. But for now, I'm hopeful. I kind of lost hope, but it's starting to come back.
Did it come as a surprise? Were you expecting that first prediction?
It was a surprise.
I was very stressed that the Aryan would pass, but given this early prediction, I am more optimistic.
Back in Paris, huge crowds supporting the left gathered at the Place de la République. The hard left leader, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, told them he was immensely relieved by the result.
We are so immensely relieved. You see... one way or another, tonight, we are now allowed to do something that we did doubt, we have to admit. We are allowed to love our country.
Our correspondent Azedi Mashiri told me a bit more about the atmosphere there.
I don't know if you can hear the sound around me, but it isn't even as loud as when the result actually came in. It was absolute jubilation, and now there is music and there is chanting. There's a building nearby. It's a building where Jean-Luc Mélenchon gave his speech a few moments ago, and he has come out several times, as have his colleagues and other members of the new Popular Front, waving outside of a window, and as soon as they appear, there are just cheers erupting around here. And yet behind me is a screen where they've been broadcasting French broadcasters, commentators, and each time Jordan Bardella's name is mentioned, the new face of the Rassemblement National, there is booing. I do want to mention, though, even though they've been completely united in... Oh, there are those boos. Even though they've been united, there it is again, in those booings, in those cheerings, not everyone supports La France Insoumise, not everyone supports Jean-Luc Mélenchon, but they do support an alliance that has kept the far right at bay somewhat.
And we should point out that it isn't Paris that's the place where the National Rally has big support, right? So the fact that he's being booed there is probably no great surprise.
Absolutely. Just this morning and over the weekend, I was in Burgundy in a town called Auxerre, and that has been a place where the National Rally has dominated local politics. Some booing again has dominated local politics for 4 years. You wouldn't hear that booing over there. It used to be a fertile ground for socialist candidates, but they have felt that the cost of living has become too difficult. They can't find jobs. They struggle to make the end of the month to pay their bills. And they believe that the answer is the far right. They were hoping that in this historic election, Marine Le Pen's party would take over government. Part of that is because they believe that Macron, the centrist project that he's created, has caused some of their problems. They think he himself is arrogant. One person said he's a king, that he thinks he's Charles III. They do not believe that he's in touch with their day-to-day problems. And Marine Le Pen's messaging, Jordan Bardella's messaging, it cut through in those areas.
Our correspondent Azedi Mashiri with me. Now, it's a very different atmosphere at the headquarters of the far-right National Rally Party. They had hoped to be celebrating. Instead, huge disappointment. Their leader, Jordan Bardella, said what he called an alliance of dishonour had kept his party out of power.
Tonight, I say this very seriously. Depriving millions of French people from the possibility will never be a viable destiny for France.
Un destin viable pour la France.
The party's former president, Marine Le Pen, said the projected result only delayed its victory. My colleague James Kumarasamy spoke to Mark Lowen, who's at the HQ of the National Rally.
I think it's a mixture of real disappointment. I mean, some of the supporters that I have spoken to said, there's one woman said, we're sad, we're disappointed, we even feel struck down by this result. And she talked about the dishonest alliance that had been formed to keep them out of power. But then another chap I spoke to tried to put a positive spin on it, and he said, you know, we've got to look at the facts. We have massively increased the number of MPs that we have in Parliament. And, we are the future of French politics. Now, who knows whether that is true? I think the strategy of the National Rally will be to say, look, that whichever government emerges from this mess will be so riven by factionalism and disunity that actually it plays into the hands of the National Rally, and that in 2027, in the presidential election, Marine Le Pen can say, well, look, this is what happens when we are blocked from power. Who knows whether that will work? Time and time again, the other side of this country and the majority in this country take a look at the National Rally, and at the 11th hour they pull back. And they, you know, that has happened once again tonight. They have just thought we are not quite prepared to bring them into power.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting that blocked from power narrative, given that this has happened at the ballot boxes, that, as you say, that the French people have voted, and they have voted, it would appear, to reject the National Rally. I mean, I wonder how easy it will be to continue that narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I think they will say, look, people did not necessarily vote for Macron or for the left. They voted for a candidate who, you know, they held their noses and voted for a candidate that would oppose the National Rally. I mean, look, it is a complicated way in which the French vote. It's not something that's unheard of here. I mean, often there is tactical voting in this country to stop the far right. I mean, going back to, you know, more than 20 years or so, to stop Jean-Marie Le Pen from getting into power as the presidential candidate when he reached the second round runoff with Jacques Chirac. I mean, people do this in France. So, yes, that narrative only holds sway to some extent. But, I mean, I think that there is a lot of frustration from the third or so of the country that supports the National Rally, that says, look, you know, this is a party that is ready for power, and once again we've been thwarted. It will now be, they will now look at what comes out of this and what government comes out of this. And whichever government takes power, James, you will know that their sole motivation really will be, or not sole motivation, but one of their largest motivations will be to be effective, to show that they can govern, so that France is not here once again in the presidential election 2027 and the next parliamentary election, you know, pulling back from the brink at the 11th hour.
Mark Lowen, one of our team of correspondents in Paris. Still to come.
The audience doesn't know John Landau, but the industry does. And they're very saddened because he was one of the most congenial, passionate lover of films and a great producer.
The film producer of Titanic and Avatar, John Landau, has died. Can Joe Biden hang on as the presidential candidate in the US election? Many Democrats are concerned about his fitness for office. The latest is the prominent US Congressman Adam Schiff. He's given an interview for US television, the NBC network's Meet the Press program, in which he suggested Vice President Kamala Harris could beat Donald Trump.
I think the vice president would be a phenomenal president. I think she has the experience, the judgment, the leadership ability to be an extraordinary president.
Could she win overwhelmingly, Congressman?
I think she very well could win overwhelmingly. But before we get into a decision about who else it should be, the president needs to make the decision whether it's him.
Dan Bowles is Washington Post's veteran political writer. What does he think is going on in Biden's inner circle right now?
The president, publicly at least, is determined to hold on. He's basically telling his critics, come out from behind those anonymous quotes and let's see whether there really is critical mass within the party for me to go. I think privately, having talked to some people who have known him for a long, long time, he's probably weighing this in a fairly intelligent way and trying to decide in the long run, not just what's best for him, according to these people, but what is best for the party and the country. Immediately after the debate, when there was so much alarm, the campaign team did a pretty good job of kind of tamping it down. And that held for a couple of days. And then last week, it started rising again. Congress has been out for the July 4th holiday week, and they return this coming week, and that will be the critical moment. If he were to step aside, he likely would say Vice President Harris should become the nominee. There would be several governors who would probably come forward and put themselves to be a potential candidate. So the Democrats are in a terrible dilemma right now, and no clear path and no consensus on what's the right way forward.
Matthew Barzun was U.S. ambassador to London at the time Joe Biden was vice president. James Naughtie asked him to reflect on his predicament.
Look, I think in the case of President Biden, in his career and in his administration, you have seen him demonstrate his ability to let go, trust an amazing Secretary of State like Tony Blinken, to empower members of his cabinet and his staff. He has built people's trust by doing the right thing. And I think he has decisions to make now that will prove whether that remain his legacy, and I hope it will.
One can only imagine that there are some pretty tough conversations going on among friends around the president at the moment.
I think within my political party as a Democrat, what many are calling for is we need to talk about this and work through it and not dismiss it and not demonize it. And that's what I'm hoping will happen in these coming days.
You know, to be absolutely frank about it, those who believe that there is a danger of him carrying on past the point where he can convince the American people that he is up to it is now pretty serious from the point of view of people in your party.
It is. It is. And I don't want in this conversation to go too much far. I mean, I'm deeply sympathetic with my friends who were there in the middle of the campaign doing this. And I know I'm not deep into it as I was before. And I think people are speaking up. People want to have a conversation, a really serious one. And that conversation needs to be had. We really can come out stronger through this. So it shouldn't be shied away from. We should embrace it. And it could devolve into intra-party recriminations and splintering. Of course it could. It doesn't have to.
Finally, just picking up that, you were an ambassador when Joe Biden was vice president. So you saw him in that role, and you know how he operates and how his political antennae operate. It's surely impossible to imagine that he does not understand that many friends would like him to make a decision that meant he didn't carry on through to November.
I think he's incredibly perceptive and wise. And so, yes, I have trust that he will really listen. And it's hard. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like in that position. But yes, to really listen. And the tricky part, and I was a friend of mine who's a crisis management counselor said that one of the hardest things about a crisis, which he finds himself in, and many of us have found ourselves in, is that you want to turn to those closest to you, your closest family and friends, but sort of perversely, they are the least well-equipped to give you the kind of information you need because they're so close to you. And so you really do need to make sure that you are listening to a wider group and that you don't lose your peripheral vision. And while it may seem like focus to you, it can end up being tunnel vision and limiting the scope.
People have to be frank.
They do. And loving and caring.
Former U.S. Ambassador to London, Matthew Barzun. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, now in its third year, has killed tens of thousands of people and left many more with lost limbs and other life-changing injuries. While the Ukrainian government keeps casualty figures under wraps in a bid to keep up morale, the Future for Ukraine Foundation estimates there have been as many as 100,000 amputations since the start of the conflict. The charity is working with the U.S. Medical Center to take soldiers over for treatment. Our correspondent Helena Humphrey has been to meet some of them.
Keep your head up.
With every tentative step on his new prosthetic legs, you can see Oleg grow in confidence, remembering who he was before the war. His new legs, made of shiny metal, attached just below his hips. On the battlefield of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine, he lost nearly his entire lower body, a memory that stays with him.
There were a lot of drones flying over my position, and one dropped a grenade directly into my trench. And since we had a lot of ammunition, it detonated, and there was a wave of explosions, wounding my legs. I put the tourniquets on, but we were under constant fire. I had to wait 10 hours to be evacuated.
Oleg was told he'd spend the rest of his life in a wheelchair. Prosthetic limbs and rehabilitation are hard to come by in a country still in the grip of war. But here at a clinic in Maryland in the United States, at least 40 Ukrainian soldiers have received prosthetic devices paid for through charitable donations. And for Oleg, being able to heal has also given him back a sense of hope.
The first time that you were able to put legs on, what was that feeling like?
It felt like when you haven't eaten for a long time and then finally you have food. It was a huge joy. I was on top of the world.
The man behind it all is Mike Corcoran. For decades, he's helped countless U.S. soldiers wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan to walk again. But he tells me even he couldn't fathom what he saw in Ukraine.
The numbers we are told are 50 times the number that the United States suffered in 20 years of war. We were told there's about 100,000 amputees. When I was last in Kyiv, we went to one of the hospitals and it was just full of combat injuries. They couldn't take care of their own. It's just staggering, the numbers.
Western military surgeons say they haven't seen injuries on this scale since World War II. And that means Ukrainian healthcare, infrastructure and society will have to adapt to meet the needs of their war wounded. This is one way. We're just down the street from the rehabilitation centre. In this workshop, they're making prosthetic limbs.
I mixed it myself.
Anatoly is carefully pouring liquid resin into a leg-shaped mould. He also lost a leg in the war. He's here in the United States being trained by Mike Corcoran, learning the crucial skills needed to meet the demand for medical devices back home. Together, they'll open a new prosthetic centre back in Kyiv. As the conflict grinds into its third year, some wounded soldiers likely won't be returning to the front lines. But like Anatoly, they're still finding ways to be part of the war effort and prepare the country for the future.
I will be able to help my brother. So much my brothers now without leg, without arms, unfortunately. But it's my will be my small part for to help them.
Very good. Swing your arms.
Back at the clinic, 23-year-old Vladislav is nearly done with his rehabilitation. He's the youngest soldier to be treated here after losing both of his legs to a mine. The staff tell me that Vladislav's grit and determination mean the progress he's made in just weeks would usually take a year. Now Vladislav walks outside, his new legs partially hidden under his battle fatigues.
Я відчуваю, не знаю, як описати цю емоцію.
I don't know how to describe this emotion. Some kind of elation. To live a full life as a normal person. And maybe I can even serve again in another branch and be helpful.
I'm going to the right.
Tomorrow, he'll head back to Ukraine, still unsure of what comes next.
Left leg, left leg, left leg. Lever, lever, lever.
That report from Helena Humphrey. Now, imagine spending more than a year cooped up in a confined space with only three other people and no contact with anyone else. Four volunteers have done just that in the name of science at the NASA base in Texas. The experiment was designed to simulate life on Mars in preparation for a future mission there. They've now emerged from their 158 square meter room in Texas. Anna Aslam takes up the story.
Just ready to come out? Hey!
That's the moment Kelly Haston, Ross Brockwell, Nathan Jones and Ankus Lario left the Mars simulator that's been their home for the past 378 days. The 3D printed habitat was designed to feel like an isolated red planet outpost that replicates the planet's unique challenges. The volunteers spent most of their time simulating operations future astronauts will have to do, including going for Mars walks in a red sandpit, growing and harvesting vegetables, and dealing with a 22-minute communication lag with Earth. NASA wants to know how the group got on with the experiments and their prolonged isolation. At a press conference, all four appear to be in high spirits.
TPO-1 has been a unique experience with great challenges, joys and sorrows, and a lot of hard work, with a fair bit of fun thrown in as well.
I'd like to say thank you to these crewmates. Thanks for tolerating my experiment in hair science.
I've got a million thoughts just kind of racing through my head right now. For instance, you know, wow, that went by quickly. And as a physician, I'm so glad that my life events led me here instead of being a proctologist.
I am astonished that I got to contribute to the one thing that is dearest to my heart, bringing life to Mars.
This mock Mars mission is a crucial step in NASA's plan to set foot on the Red Planet by the early 2040s. The volunteers were thanked for devoting a year of their lives to serve humanity's exploration of space.
John Landau, who produced James Cameron's epic Titanic and Avatar, two of the biggest films of all time, has died of cancer at the age of 63. Titanic, which won John Landau an Oscar, was the first film to earn $1 billion at the box office. Peter Jackson, who made the Lord of the Rings trilogy, described him as one of cinema's monumental figures. Jeannie Wolfe is a Hollywood Entertainment reporter who interviewed him.
The audience doesn't know John Landau, but the industry does. And they're very saddened because he was one of the most congenial, passionate lover of films and a great producer. And so I think the film community really is shaken by his loss. He said, look, I can't compose. I can't act. He started as a film executive. And he said, I guess that's why I'm producing. But let's remember, James Cameron always wanted the most elaborate, the most expensive production. And you needed a producer to keep things calm and in shape and get the money people interested. John Landau was a doll, a darling man. He talked about the fact that he took Titanic because he cried when he read the script.
Is there anyone there?
Yes, what do you see?
Iceberg, right ahead!
Thank you.
And if you asked him, what's your favorite part of producing? He would say, I like to be there in the audience when the audience is first seeing the film. I like to look at the faces. I like to feel what they're feeling. I like to feel when they're restless so I know if anything needs to be cut. Honestly, it was just wonderful to be around him because he took these gigantic number one films and let them tell a message, let them spread the word to society that Titanic was a film about the people, not about the sinking of the ship, but about the great characters who were part of that film. Same with Avatar.
I came like this, this you. I turn, I feel the wind, I turn very strong.
Yeah, I bank so.
He wanted to protect all those performances. He was incredibly proud of what they achieved and incredibly proud that they passed on an ecological, a climate-saving message without hitting people on the head. That was his life, and that was the legacy that he leaves.
Hollywood Entertainment reporter Jeannie Wolfe. Now, as France is taking in its surprise parliamentary election results, there's a celebration of one of Paris's most famous landmarks, the Moulin Rouge. 2 months ago, the cabaret club's famous logo, the windmill, was left without its huge sails when they suddenly fell off during the night. Now they've been restored just in time for the Paris Olympics. Stephanie Zacherson has the details.
In a can-can show in front of the club, one of the most visited attractions in the French capital, it stands as dazzled spectators gathered in the street outside, the red and gold sails of the windmill just behind them, lighting up the Parisian night just as they've been doing for more than 100 years. The blades inexplicably fell off in April, but have now been restored. Jane Bard is one of the cabaret dancers dressed up in a frilled red, white and blue dress for the show.
We were all very sad and it was something that like we couldn't even believe that happened. We're so thankful that no one was hurt, but it was also so lovely to receive so many messages from the public and everyone around the world like sent us messages to say that we're feeling so sorry for you guys and we hope your wings will be back up soon. And so that was really touching, and like tonight I'm just so happy to see it lit up again and to be dancing in front of it. Like, we don't get to do this every night, so tonight's definitely one for the history book.
And the venue is truly a part of the capital's history. When its doors opened in 1889, it was the first building in Paris to use the marvellous new technology of electricity to light up and spin the wings of the windmill. The original complex was ravaged by a fire in 1915, but rebuilt a couple of years later. So when the wings broke earlier this year, the venue made sure to pull out all the stops to get them back into place, just in time for when the Olympic torch is due to pass the landmark. The director, Jean-Victor Clericot, called it a new beginning, a new line in the story of the Moulin Rouge.
C'est une journée, une soirée particulière. C'est beaucoup d'excitation, beaucoup d'émotion.
It's a special evening. There's a lot of excitement, a lot of emotion, because obviously we remember what happened 2 months ago. We've received so much support from everyone, and it's quite emotional to now see this fervour again here on Blanche Square.
The sails have been recreated exactly as the previous ones, but they're not rotating yet. A little more time is needed to install the motorization system. But the show is back on, like the wings of the Moulin Rouge.
Stephanie Zacherson reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we included, drop us an email, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or on X, you'll find us as @globalnewspod. This edition was produced by Julie Frankel and mixed by Daniel Fox. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.